Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
How is it even possible? It has been 3 years, 3 years this week of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. How are you? It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Boy, we got a lot of great stuff going on right now. I am very excited about our guests that we've got today. Our first guest coming up in about 7 or 8 minutes, Craig Chartier. He is the director of the Plymouth Archaeological Rediscovery Project. And let me tell you about this guy. He figured out from the archaeological discoveries of a home of one of the old pilgrims, John Howland, what their house looked like, how it was shaped and structured. And then he took the inventory from when this man died and was actually able to place where those things were within that house in order to recreate the house and how the man lived and some of the things about his lifestyle. A fascinating thing that you might be able to do with one of your ancestors. So we're going to talk to Craig about that experience and what he learned and what he found. Should be pretty interesting coming up in just a bit. Then later in the show, we're going to visit with a man we talked to almost a year ago, Steve Anderson. You may recall this. He was raised by his mom and dad in Minnesota, one of 9 kids in the family. And through certain circumstances, they learned that their dad wasn't their dad. In fact, they found out that there were at least 8 fathers for the 9 children. Well, some things have happened since we last were into that story. It was episode 100, by the way, if you're going to check back on the podcast. He'll fill us in on the latest on that story coming up later in the show. But right now, it's time to get back from vacation with our good friend David Allen Lambert, the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org. Are you rested and tanned, David?
I will say the tanning wasn't as good as I wanted, but definitely well rested.
Well, it was a nice break. You went to Williamsburg. I went to Hawaii. And did you discover anything exciting there in Williamsburg?
That I can fire a 69 caliber Brown Best flintlock musket and get 12 shots on a target.
Woo!
Quite a far distance away. So I guess I would have been good for the Revolutionary War,
yes.
Which kind of ties into earlier this week. The Sons of the American Revolution had their 126th Congress in Boston, and I was honored beyond belief to be sworn in as a new member by the President General Thomas Lawrence in Boston at NEHGS. So
wow.
I am now an SAR member. Number 198863.
There are a lot of us. I'm a member as well, and that's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, compatriot.
Yes, exactly. All right, let's get on with our family histoire news. What do you have for us today?
Well, we have a gentleman by the name of Mark who, when he was about 20 years old in the early 1960s, was told by his father that he was actually adopted. He found his mother and found out her name was Irene Gladys Oldfield. She had given him up for adoption at 9 months of age. He had been born in 1942 over in England during World War II. Well, he went on to the internet, figured out who she was. Unfortunately, she died in Canada and Ontario in 2010, but it listed Diane, John, Jeanette, Jim, Doug, Annette, Carol, Denise, and Robert as her children. So he had a new family. He's been in touch with them and been reunited. So a war baby that was put up for adoption in England is now reunited with a whole new bunch of siblings and no doubt nephews and nieces and great nephews and nieces. So
wow.
That's a wonderful story.
That's very cool.
Well, digging back a little further, they now believe they may have found a shrine that contains part of the skull of Buddha.
And who is they?
This is the Chinese archaeologist that found a 1,000-year-old shrine containing the skull of Buddha himself, and it is 4 foot by 1.5 feet long, covered with gold and gemstones and glass, and it was found underneath a temple, what they were doing an excavation, and they found a chamber underneath, and voila, there it was. My biggest question is, now will they do DNA? Who's the first one that's going to be able to get in to look at it?
And who's going to find out they have DNA that matches Buddha?
Exactly. So that's another episode of Extreme Genes. And by the way, happy anniversary.
Thank you, sir.
Also kind of war-related, the Japanese government and some lawmakers are considering raising the Japanese World War II battleship Yamato, which sunk back in 1945 as it was steaming towards Okinawa. On board the vessel were over 3,000 war dead that never were reclaimed, and they're still with the ship. So there's some people that say, leave them there. Others that want to bring up the vessel and see them have proper burials. Personally, I think they should just leave it as a burial at sea.
Well, you know, that's one of the challenges we all face is where do we spend our public monies and what's worth the most, right?
Absolutely. My tech tip is for you to muster up your family tree. So look through your charts and see what male ancestors you might have from the colonial time through the 19th or early 20th century that fit in the age range of about 16 to maybe the mid-30s, and then see what wars were going on at that time. Create a little timeline sheet and then see, because I just met with a batch of people from the Sons of the American Revolution that didn't even realize that some of their ancestors they had fit. So they now have new supplemental ancestors.
That's very cool. I like that.
I think it's kind of a fun thing to try. So there's that. And in today's American Ancestors free database, we have cemetery records from 1724 to 1986, over 25,500. And again, this is just a free database brought to you by American Ancestors for our guest users. Well, that's about all I have from Beantown. It's nice to be back to work again and look forward to talking to you next week, my friend.
All right. Great chatting with you as always, David. We'll talk to you then. And coming up next, we're going to talk to Craig Chartier. He is the director of the Plymouth Archaeological Recovery Project. We're going to talk about how he actually took the archaeological studies of the house of a man who lived 300, 400 years ago, and then matched that with his inventory to take you on a tour of the house and how the whole thing was put together. It's an amazing journey. You're going to want to hear more about it on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. You know, it wasn't that long ago that David Allen Lambert, the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org, came on and gave us a little tech tip about using modern technology to map out what your ancestor's home or maybe even your childhood home or your grandfather's home looked like back in the day, and use that to share with children and grandchildren what their ancestors' lifestyle was about. Hi, it's Fisher. This is Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show on ExtremeGenes.com. And over the weekend, I was looking through the website for the Pilgrim John Howland. He is my 10th great-grandfather, and it was very interesting to see that they've been excavating his home site in Plymouth, Massachusetts now for many decades. And recently, a man named Craig Chartier, he's the director of the Plymouth Archaeological Project, wrote a great piece about how they took the inventory of John Howland from when he passed away in the 1670s and then matched it up with the archaeology of the house. And this, of course, could apply to all kinds of people doing this, whether you're in the South or the West or whatever. If you have descriptions of your ancestors' place and you have their inventory, you can do some fascinating stuff. And I've got Craig on the line with me right now. Hi, Craig. Welcome to Extreme Genes.
Hey, Scott. Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Just to give a little background on John Howland's house, how long has it been since they started excavation there?
The first excavations were carried out way back in like 1936 to 1938. They started doing the excavations there on one of the anniversaries of when the house was originally built, because it was built in 1636 or 1638. So, you know, on the 300th anniversary, they wanted to do some work and actually do some some archaeology there and see what it looked like.
And he and his wife, Elizabeth Tilley, lived there for 30-some-odd years or something like that before he passed on, and then she moved in with her son, Jabez. So what did they find during the course of this excavation, by the way?
What they ended up finding was the actual outline of the whole house. It was a rectangular house, kind of small. It wasn't a big, huge, fancy house or anything. It had a really large chimney, about a 9-foot wide by about 4-foot deep chimney covering in one entire wall of the house. And then the rest of the house was divided into one big main room with a small room attached to that. So that big main room would have been the hall, and then a small room would have been the parlor, sort of a more intimate room. And then it kind of had a little attachment on the back, a little L, little lean-to kind of extension that was on the back of the house, all with a stone foundation. And then what's really interesting, too, is what they did is John Howland used a piece of his old armor. He used a piece of armor as either a fireback inside the hearth or to cover up a hole in the hearth or something, but they actually found a piece of John Howland's armor inside the hearth.
I had no idea that the Pilgrims brought armor with them from England. Unbelievable.
Yeah, big old piece of armor. It must have been really heavy, a whole suit of armor to wear. You know, it would have been a breastplate and a backplate. The piece that they found was a tassel that would cover the upper part of your leg, but the thing must have been huge and heavy. You can see why they would have gotten rid of it, you know, pretty soon. But
Now, just off the top of my head, John died in 1672, as I recall, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And at the time, of course, as was the process then, and very much so now in many, many places, they did an inventory of his estate, which meant they listed all the things that he owned, because even his wife couldn't inherit it without going through the proper process, right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly right.
And so through this, you were able to take this list of things that he had and then look at it as the inventory people basically giving you a tour of the house. Now, you had the outline of the house, so you knew what the place looked like, what the layout was. And so I loved your article because you were able to actually take us on a tour of the inside of John Howland's house. Explain how you did this, how this came to mind, and what some of the things were and what they told you about his lifestyle.
Oh, the whole process started when the Howlands contacted me about doing a final report. I mean, like I said, the site was excavated back in the 30s, but there had never been a report done on the site. And, you know, the Howlands are very passionate about their ancestors and were always interested in trying to find out anything they can about their ancestors. And so, as an archaeologist, you can either write a report that's very scientific with lots of jargon that, you know, bores people to tears.
Yes.
That becomes just a too-long-didn't-read kind of report. Or you can try to tell a story, and that's one of the important aspects of archaeology is to try to tell a story about the past. And so I was trying to come up with, you know, some story using the historical documents, using the archaeological evidence that we had there to try to tell a story about John Howland's life, to try to sort of bring it to life, bring his house and his wife's house to life. And the lovely thing, the wonderful thing about this site is that it had a really, really clearly defined archaeology. And it also had a probate that was really, really detailed. Sometimes you get these probates, and it'll list just everything that's in the house, and there won't be really any order to it. They'll list a coat next to a horse, and they'll list a kettle, you know, next to a cart, and it just didn't seem like it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
But in this case here, you could really, just as soon as you started reading the probate, you could really get an idea, feeling that you could walk around inside the house. And so that's what I tried to do. When I took a look at the probate and tried to write up something interesting about the probate analysis. Like I said, not every probate is like that, but every once in a while you come across a real nice gem that it gives you the chance to really get inside of people's heads and, you know, get a real feeling for the people who are there. And so I just, mentally in my head, I had that outline of the house, and I knew what it looked like, and then I just started looking at the probate. And, you know, people would go through a front door to get in the house, and so if you think about first thing they're going to see when they go through the front door, I just started with that. And then it just naturally flowed as you went around the house. There wasn't a lot of really head scratching. The people who did the probate had listed things just as they must have seen them all throughout the house. So it was really a fascinating read going through it.
So they went from the front door, and then you were able to determine by the list of the items, okay, they went this way into this room, and then to the back of this room, and then over into the cooking area. And you were able to actually just virtually see where they went because of the way they listed it, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you could see that when they went to the front door, the first thing they listed was his musket, his long gun, his cutlass. You know, it was the very first thing. So that must have been right inside the door.
So that tells you basically it's there for protection and something you could grab at the last moment before you open the door, right?
Exactly. I mean, they were living, you know, basically on what was a frontier in Plymouth Colony back in the 1630s. It was in Kingston, Mass, and they were out on a little peninsula called Rocky Nook, but it was still a frontier, and you never knew what might be happening. There could have been Spanish coming, there could have been Native Americans coming, so it'd be really common to keep your weapons right inside the door there so you could have access to them as soon as you open that door. But after that, the next thing they started talking about was things right by the hearth, and we knew where the hearth was in the house from the archaeology.
Right.
And so we knew that once you go inside the house, you had to turn left to get to the hearth. And so by knowing that, we know that the door must have opened to the right and that all the firearms and stuff were just on the inside of the door on the left-hand side. And then you could look at, you know, all the items that were in the hearth, which there wasn't a lot. But as they sort of left the hearth area, all of a sudden things were divided into what looked like a man's side and a woman's side of the hearth. It was all the sharp tools, the axes, hatchets, mortising axes, hoes, pickaxes, those sorts of things on one side. And then it looked like on the other side was all the things like kettles and pots and pans and chains and things like that, and things that would be associated with, you know, with doing the cooking. So you could just imagine that Elizabeth had her side of the hearth, and John had his side of the hearth, and you know, the sharpening stone was over in his side of the hearth, so that's probably where he'd be sitting and doing all of his sharpening. And then, you know, as you leave the hearth, you can just sort of imagine how you'd be traveling around the rest of the room. And one of the really neat things that he encountered looking at the probates was a lot of books that were right inside the house.
Did you find out what the books were? Did they identify them specifically?
Some of them were identified, you know, pretty specifically. Some of them were just sort of general names. One was called the Great Bible, and there was actually a Bible back in the 17th century called the Great Bible, a big G and a big B, and that was the first authorized version of the Bible in English. That was authorized by Henry VIII.
Right.
So that was probably, you know, a copy of that Great Bible. Some of the other books, it just said something like, you know, seven more books. Now, it's one of those things where when you read that as a researcher, you get frustrated. It's like, oh, you know, why couldn't you just write what those seven other books were?
Yeah.
We have to go look at Elizabeth's probate later on, and she listed some books in there that matched up with those earlier books, and we were able to kind of fill in some details about what some of those other books were as well. So,
wow.
That other probate in her will.
In the excavation, were any of the items listed in the inventory ever recovered?
Yeah, we don't know exactly if those were the exact same things, but, you know, we found things like axes. One of the things they mentioned were jugs and earthenware and earthen pots, and we found fragments of those sorts of things. Talked about a lot of pewter platters and things like wedges, iron wedges. Those are common inside the inventory, and a bunch of iron wedges were actually found during the excavation. So it, you know, there was the opportunity to actually match up, you know, some of the things that are shown in that probate with actual, you know, the actual artifacts that were found. One of the neat things that was in the probate, too, was a set of scales that somebody who was, you know, engaged in selling things would be using to weigh coins, to weigh, you know, silver and gold and that kind of thing. And we didn't find an actual set of scales, but there actually was a scale weight of a specific denomination that was found in the excavations that must have gone with that set of scales as well.
Well, hopefully with technology, you'll actually be able to recreate his home digitally and show where all these things were. I mean, that would be an incredible thing to have for Howland descendants. And, of course, a great example for many other people who might want to have access to information about their own homes, you know, get some information from the inventories of their ancestors and put it all together as you have.
Exactly.
Well, awesome, Craig. Thank you so much for your time and sharing this information. I've never seen anything quite like what you wrote, and it was very impressive. And we appreciate your time coming on Extreme Genes.
Great talking to you. Thank you very much for having me.
He's Craig Chartier. He's the director of the Plymouth Archaeological Project. And coming up next, we'll revisit Steve Anderson, the man who came from a family of nine children with eight fathers. And they didn't know it. Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And it was about a year ago, maybe 11 months, that we had a man on from Minnesota who gave us a story that I think has been talked about perhaps more than any other story we've had on in the entire 3 years of Extreme Genes. Steve Anderson is his name, and the story was about discovering the fact that in his family of nine children, there were eight fathers, and yet they were all raised by the same man, and no, he wasn't the father of any of them. And Steve is back on the line with me right now. How are you, Steve? Welcome back to Extreme Genes.
Thanks, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
So just going back to the beginning, Steve, you discovered at one point, as a result of an accident that involved a brother, the fact that your dad's blood could not be used to help him out when he was in the hospital because dad's blood didn't match. And that was your first hint that there was something uniquely different about your family, correct?
That's right. And then that was followed by two other sisters who, because of some events, my mom actually just told them outright that they did not belong to that, and in fact told them who their fathers were. The third one didn't know probably until she was about 56 years old, so it was a real surprise to her. But that started the research, the questions that we started looking into, and you know, never really got very far with until DNA testing became affordable.
Right.
And so my brother and I sort of together began the search using DNA and found some fascinating answers to some questions.
Well, that's exactly true. Now, of course, you wound up confronting your mom. And for people who want to hear the whole story, we're not going to do the whole thing all over again. Listen to episode 100 on the podcast, and you can catch the whole thing. So the bottom line was, is you discovered that of your siblings, the whole group, the whole family, nine of you, that there were eight different fathers involved. You confronted your mother. She left you a list of the names of all the different dads. And since we last talked in, I think it was August of last year, your mom has passed. So what has changed as a result of that, if anything? And did she have anything further to say about it before she passed away?
Well, she did. Before she passed away, about a month or two before she passed away, you know, she was 93 when she died, and I confronted her when she was 90. So this is relatively recent. And after I initially confronted her and she gave me the names and stuff, I then talked to my sister, who then approached her and asked some more questions. She basically got the answer that her and two of the other sisters belong to Dad. Well, when she left there, she said, "I don't believe that." Was tested and found out she didn't. So she called one of the other sisters and said, "You know, we want to get you tested." She got tested and found out she was not Dad's. So the only one left then was the one sister that we really can't tell yet.
Mm.
And she, at this point, doesn't know yet.
So she has no idea, and this is kind of by design that you don't want to inform her at the moment because of the fact that she's made up a little differently than the rest of you in terms of how she handles things like this, yes?
Yeah, she would probably be the one that would, because she really wants to know all the answers, she would probably start talking to people around town, and she's the only one living back there in that town, by the way.
Mm-hmm. In Minnesota.
And we really... It's just not, we just don't feel comfortable with her starting to ask these questions and approaching people, because we kind of, through the years, have found that a lot of the people in town sort of knew what was happening. And thank goodness we as kids didn't know that. It was just impossible to live there had
yes.
we known that.
Of course. So did Mom reveal anything further before she passed about what was the root of all of this? Because she stayed married to your dad for 25 years the entire time you were all growing up.
She did. And, you know, it was interesting because we know that Dad knew about some of them. We don't know how many he knew about. But, you know, he never once said anything derogatory about my mother. And, in fact, one time when I got really angry with her about something, I was, you know, a teenager.
Yeah.
And, you know how they are. And he, you know, really got after me saying, "Don't you ever talk about your mother that way. You show her respect." You know, at that time I thought, "Oh, yeah." And now I look at it and I just think, wow. Well, you know, he was really protecting her. And has, you know, to the day he died, he never said anything that would indicate that she had done anything inappropriate.
Well, and last time we talked, you had speculated that perhaps he just was unable to have children, and this might have been some kind of arrangement.
Well, you know, that was the joke for a while there. You know, for quite a while, we knew about the three siblings, and we kind of kidded around with ourselves, saying, "Wouldn't that be funny if we found out Dad was sterile?" And now, you know, nine kids later, none of them his, and he lived with my mother for 25 years. How do you not get somebody pregnant when you're living with them for a husband and wife for 25 years?
Right. Yeah.
Sure adds some legitimacy to that joke, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Let's fast forward here a little bit because you had a family reunion here in the past month or so. How'd that go in Minnesota?
Well, my mom passed away in December, and within our family, when people die in December and January, we don't typically have a big funeral for them. We kind of either cremate them or... It's a very small, little, intimate gathering of a couple people to make it official, and then we all get together when the weather's warmer. We did that not too long ago, just a couple of weeks ago. We've all made a promise nobody's going to say anything to anybody until after the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
After the funeral is over, we told our brother, this is the one, the very first one, that found out he wasn't Dad's. We told him, and he says, "Yeah, I figure that's probably the situation." And so the only one left is the one sister. And I wanted to tell her just because I thought she needed to know. First of all, the reason that I started the DNA testing was so that I tested mom, paid to have mom and dad tested, and then while I was doing it, I thought, well, let's have me tested too. I know I'm dad, so, but for grins and giggles. And the idea was that anybody else in the family who wanted to could then pay to have themselves tested because we had the base already created. And so I thought, okay, everybody has a right to know. But the rest of the siblings said, don't you dare tell her. And so, long story short, in the end, I left and she, at this point, doesn't know.
And you're still trying to figure out among your siblings exactly when and how to tell her.
Yeah, and you know, most of them say, you know, she's almost 70 years old. She can take it to the grave with her. It's not going to ruin her life not to know at this point. You know, we do want to make sure we keep peace in the family, too. You know, none of this was ever done to tear apart the family or to cause grief to any one person. So we want to be real careful with that.
Well, and it's a very delicate thing, and that's one of the side effects, I guess you'd say, of DNA testing, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, my brother always says, Steve, be careful what you ask. You may not like the answer. You know, I'm fine with the answer. I really am. The first 3 months took some really big adjustment. No, it's just a funny story, you know.
Right. It's something that happened.
Yeah. I'm not so sure my sister would think it's that funny, though. That's the one we haven't told yet. So.
He's Steve Anderson. He comes from one of the most unique families we've ever run across on Extreme Genes. Thanks so much for coming on, Steve, and giving us an update.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And coming up next, it is preservation time with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority. He's got a question from a listener in Maui. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. And Tom, it was 3 years ago that we launched this show, and you were here from the very get-go.
Isn't that amazing? 3 years just went by, boom.
And now we're on over 40 radio stations around the country and continuing to grow. And we thank so many people for making all this possible because it's a fun ride.
Oh, it is. It's been so much fun. I love getting these letters at AskTom at TMCPlace.com and interacting with different people and finding out what they're interested in, where they're going with their preservation. It's just so much fun to help them get their stuff going.
All right, we've got this email from Ana Taua in Maui, Hawaii.
Woo.
And she said, I just happened to be listening to KAOI radio on Maui early Sunday morning, and I heard your show. Can you tell me what I'm seeing? She said she was looking down into, I guess it's the sprockets on an old VHS tape, and sees white spots in there, kind of the size of a pencil eraser. And she wants to know if she can still transfer videos with this on it. What is that? What's she seeing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we see this a lot in high humidity places like Maui, and I think we need to get over there and have a scanning party.
I just got back. I had a great time. It was fantastic.
No, that's great. Yeah, we get these a lot in the southeast areas and places like that where there's a lot of humidity. What it is, you get mold spores in there. And then when there's a lot of humidity, the mold just grows, and that's what they are. They're little white spots. So if you ever have a tape and you're looking down at the top, there's usually two little clear windows. Mm-hmm. If you see those white spots like she did, what they are is they're mold, and they're mold spores. So they can still be transferred to DVD. You just have to be really careful. Now, one thing I want to warn her about is don't preview these tapes unless you're going to throw your VCR away when you're done. Because what will happen is if you run one of these mold spore ones through your VCR, they'll get on your heads.
Right.
And then you have a clean tape that you run behind it, and then it's going to put the mold spores on there, which you will not see immediately. However, over a little bit of time, they're going to grow just like the other ones did because of the humidity in Hawaii.
And so what does that do? What does a spore from mold actually do to a tape?
Well, it doesn't really hurt the tape. What it does, it just grows. And so the bad thing is it'll get on your heads and it'll spread just like a virus. And so that's the bad part. Then it'll spread to your next tape, anything you ever play in that VCR will probably now get mold spores and grow mold on it.
So you have to do what then? Get one particular machine that's specified just for mold spores and then get rid of it when you're done?
Exactly. We've had people who brought in hundreds of those. And we have two things. We say, hey, do you have an old VCR that you don't want anymore that we can use? And if they do, then we'll use theirs to run their entire job and then destroy it after then. Don't give it to Goodwill or, you know, any place like that because you're going to be giving this disease to somebody else.
So what do if they don't have that machine?
We go to Goodwill or DI or someplace like that and get a VCR, and we run their job. And when we're done with their job, we, you know, throw it away. Because you can go in and clean it, but the thing is, mold spores are so teeny tiny, the chances of getting every single one is pretty, you know, slim. Like when we're doing standard transfers, you know, after so many passes, we go in and clean the heads anyway.
Right.
And even though 99% of the time, once we transfer a VHS tape to a DVD, the chances are they're never going to use the tape again. However, I don't want to make that decision for somebody. I want them to have the tape back. If they want to do something with it, fine. If they want to throw it away, then that's up to them. But I want to make sure when we give them their tape back, it's in as good or better condition than when they brought it into us.
And, of course, we want to keep the originals for as long as possible as well, because you might want to digitize it again someday with better technology, right?
Right. To an extent, that's mostly with film and things, because anytime you're dealing with something that's optical, like negative, slides, Super 8 film, 8mm, 60mm, all those kind of things, as new technology comes out, you can scan it at a higher resolution and it will look better. In fact, in our next segment, let's get a little bit more into the differences between magnetic transfers and optical transfers. A lot of times people get confused. Like, we have people that bring in old VHS tapes that want them on Blu-ray because they think they're going to look better. Well, if you take a VHS tape and transfer it to a DVD and play it in a Blu-ray player, it's going to look exactly the same as if you put it on a Blu-ray player and play it in a Blu-ray player. Because the neat thing about Blu-ray players is the new technology, it actually up-converts other DVDs. So if you have an old favorite Disney DVD you've watched for years, when you get your Blu-ray player and you pop that in on your high-def television, you'll actually see it looks better. It hasn't physically changed a DVD. It just goes through and up-converts it to make it look better.
Hmm.
And the thing is, the difference is, we were talking at just the tail end of the earlier segment, is you have magnetic things. Your VHS tapes, your Video 8 tapes, your Mini DV tapes, all these different kinds of physical tapes have magnets on them, basically little teeny particles of magnetic, and moving those particles around is what makes your photo or your picture, just like on audio, it makes your sound.
Right.
And basically what it does, it runs through what we call a head. It's a little electronic head that reads the electronic impulses and turns it into a signal. Now, that's not going to change no matter what kind of equipment you have. The only way it's going to change is if you go through another piece of equipment that can enhance the colors. You can go in and do other ways to manipulate the magnetic pieces themselves, but the actual record head itself, it doesn't care what it is. It's
right.
Not like, oh, this is going to be better. It's going to be a higher particle count. There's only so many particles
right.
There.
You can't change the quality.
Exactly. That won't change. We need another piece of equipment in between. And this is one thing that we've talked about many times. You want to be very, very careful. Whoever transfers your audio or videotapes, make sure they do it in real time. I have seen on the internet where people do VHS tapes for like $10, $11, $12 a piece. There's no way physically you could make money at charging somebody $10 for that much of work. If you're going to do it in real time, it's going to take like 2.5 hours to do a normal VHS tape. You'll go broke. You want people to do it in real time because the fidelity is so much better. So what a lot of people do is they take this 2-hour tape, which in our case would take about 2.5 hours. What they do, they run it at such high speed, they can do it in 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So,
and you lose a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Anytime you do anything fast, you're going to lose it. Audio, it's not as bad, but I still recommend even audio being done in real time. There are some people that do it in high speed and convert it, which isn't as bad because there's not as much information on an audio tape as there is
sure.
On a videotape. But anytime, you know, if your only concern is, hey, I can't afford it, this is the only way I'm going to be able to get it transferred, it's better than nothing. If that's the only way you can get your tapes to DVD, that's the only way it's going to happen for you, then go ahead and do it. But hang on to your videotape, because as you mentioned in the first segment, maybe 5, 6, 7 years from now, your kids will want to get a better quality transfer. They'll still have your old tape, and they'll be able to do it later and get the better transfer at doing it at real time.
Well, you want to get it from the original. You
exactly.
Don't want to make the copy from a bad copy, obviously.
Exactly. And that brings up another thing, too. We have people come into our store all the time that have like Mini DV camcorders or Video 8 camcorders. And most people didn't have that size of VCRs. So they would transfer their Video 8s or Mini DVs to a VHS so they could watch them, which is going backwards. And then they bring in the VHS, say, we want this on a DVD, which now you're on third generation. So it's not going to look anywhere near as good as going back to your original and going to a DVD or a Blu-ray from that.
Getting worse and worse. Thanks so much, Tom.
Good to be here.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us. That wraps things up for this week. Just a reminder, sign up for our brand new newsletter, The Weekly Genie. It's free. You can sign up at extremejeans.com and on our Facebook page. And if you missed any of today's show, of course, catch the podcast on extremejeans.com, iTunes, or iHeartRadio's Talk Channel. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.